The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Roger talks about medicine without politics. Jennifer outruns you and the bear. A new mystery guest starts at the beginning, but to what end? A Santa Fe pitcher gets in the middle of a biologic. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show says. Check it out for yourself.
The fellow out his window and yell for me to hear, "Hey, buddy, how can I get this car out of second gear?"
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Randy, say hello and introduce yourself, your name of your company, and what do you do?
My name is Randy Berholtz. I'm the co-founder and the chief executive officer of Rancho Santa Fe Bio. We are a clinical stage calcific disorders company, and we're based in San Diego, California.
Okay, that was sufficiently short, so I didn't interrupt you to tell us we don't understand what you said. But we didn't understand what you said. So let's go back.
Sure.
Start part by part slowly.
Sure. So
Rancho Santa Fe Bio, we got that part. What is the clinical stage stuff?
So essentially, we make drugs that can allow patients who have heart disease to not have to get as many open heart surgeries, or to get any open heart surgeries over time.
How many people have heart disease and what portion of them end up having open heart surgery?
So we deal with a certain type of heart disease called a progressive aortic valve stenosis. And
all you medical guys, you're always using these big words. So just break it down. Tell us what each word is. So aorta, which one is that?
So everybody has four valves in their heart. The main valve is the aortic valve. What can happen with people over time is that the aortic valve gets calcified. The actual good part of the valve shrinks until that person has to get an open heart surgery and to get a replacement valve.
This is different from when the plaque builds up on the inside of the arteries, right? That's not the same thing.
That's right.
Okay. So this is the
calcium. That's right.
So calcium builds up on the actual valve. The valve can't open and close properly or what?
That's right. Yeah. So most patients have three cusps on their valve. And so what happens over time, it doesn't allow the valve to open and close, 60 times a minute or the
So
like.
It slows it down, but does it close just as well, or does it also make it so that that seal isn't as good?
I mean, combination. If you don't do anything about it, what will happen is the patient will die.
Is it that the valve isn't closing and sealing well, or is it just doesn't do it as often?
It doesn't do it as often, and it's more difficult to do it.
So it slows you down, it gets tougher, and eventually you get so tired or it gets so slow that you don't get enough blood, and then you die, right?
Exactly.
So you have a drug that does what? Does it stop it from getting worse, or does it, decalcify it, or what does it do?
Decreases the progression of this calcium buildup. It slows it down.
Very specific to that. Does it do other valves or just that one?
And so that's what it works on.
So let's talk about how these drugs come to be and the process by which, they become something that a patient can use. So
this drug originated from Sanofi, a French pharmaceutical company. Sanofi tried the drug on three other non-aortic valve stenosis indications, and it didn't work. But what they did was they created a very large safety database.
FDA approval has to be safe and effective.
That's
so
right.
They've demonstrated that it's safe, just not effective.
Exactly.
You can take it, but it doesn't work.
Well, that's right. Well, for those indications. So Dr. Jordan Miller from the Mayo Clinic was doing research on aortic valve stenosis and was looking at this type of drug. It's a guat form formation of drug.
It's a what formation drug?
Guat, called a soluble guanylate cyclase activator.
Okay, lots of big words there. Guac is the abbreviation for that?
Guat is the chemical compound of the drugs. So there are a bunch of drugs out there that like varacaguat. Ours is called atacicaguat.
All right, so they all end in guat.
The drug was put by Sanofi into the National Institutes of Health repurposed drug program. And so Dr. Miller found the drug there, thought it looked good for his purposes. He in-licensed the drug from Sanofi. He did preclinical work. He did a phase one, and he also did phase two clinical trials.
All right, so let's just talk for a second. What is it to in-license? You just pay a licensing fee and you get an exclusive right to use it for some indication or what?
That's right.
Dr. Miller does these experiments, says this is a great idea, and starts to get patents. So what kind of patents can you get around these things?
The patents we have right now are process patents, method patents. And that's what a company has right now. It's method patents.
So when you say a method, you know, in the patent world, there's combination of matter, and then there's method and system or apparatus instead of system. So a method is a sequence of steps that you take to produce an outcome, right?
That's right. It's a method of use.
You get the drug however you get it. So what is the special about the method of use? I mean, it's not just a pill. You take the pill, you're good to go.
What's the whole mechanism with these SGC activators? It's essentially the use of an SGC activator to slow the progression of calcium buildup in the aortic valve.
Right, an SGC activator, more initials. Oh my goodness!
I'm telling you.
All right, so all of this stuff. See, if it all passes the FDA, then you guys get rich because you sell billions of dollars worth, right? So there must be in all such processes some, what's the right word for it, some interaction with computers. I want to hear about how computers are used in any and all parts of this process. Let's just talk about that because this is the cyber show. So we should be talking about something cyber, not that we have to. Is this something where they do computer modeling to figure out which are candidates and then work on the ones that look like they're good candidates? Or what do they do in those processes?
Yeah, that was, I'm sure, done at Sanofi where they do molecular modeling. And during my initial days in drug discovery efforts for a company here in San Diego area, that was our main utilization apparatus. When we synthesized a whole series of drugs, we would feed that information into the computer, do some modeling for the active site of an enzyme, and see how our drug fits on a molecular level into that active site on the enzyme.
The drug has a molecule, it has a shape, and that shape is going to match up with some shape somewhere else. And that those shapes matching up are how the thing gets attached and how it does its job. Is that right?
Exactly. They have a crystalline structure of an enzyme or a receptor, that are present in cells. And then they model their drug such that it fits appropriately and selectively into that site on the enzyme or on the receptor.
Yeah. Okay, so the appropriately is that it actually matches up to the right thing, and selectively is it doesn't match up to other things and therefore cause things to go bad that shouldn't, right?
Absolutely, safe and effective. That's all you get.
All right, so that's computer modeling. So this is one drug you're working on, but my understanding is you have other drugs as well that are candidates, right?
True, those are being manufactured by, or have been, synthesized by the folks at Mayo. I'm sure that they're doing some what's called structure activity analysis using some computer molecular modeling to help aid them in their synthetic efforts and their target molecules.
So they actually synthesize new stuff and then they can reproduce it later, as well as taking natural stuff and selectively breeding it or whatever mechanism they use to produce different things to try. And then they use models first. Okay, so now they're done with the modeling and they have a bunch of candidates that the model says might be okay. So they must use computers somewhere else in the process. They don't just feed that, I guess they feed it to mice or something. But what's the rest of the process?
The rest of the process is just certain methodologies, time-honored methodologies that they have in the laboratory. They'll isolate an enzyme and do some activity analysis. They'll take a cell where this receptor is known to be present and see if their drugs will be effective in that cell type.
So all this stuff used to be done by people with, microscopes and tweezers, right? And you create a plate of agar and you put it in a bunch of places. There's a lot of automation behind that stuff now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
so they use computer vision to go look and see whether something's growing or not, whether something's broken. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Part of the moving it forward into clinical trials involves, as I understand it, producing some volume of it, right?
Correct.
So to produce that volume, of course, that's not done by hand with agar and Petri dishes, right? How's that done?
In manufacturing facilities. It's where they devise a synthetic pathway at the lab bench, and then they take that into a scale-up situation where they go from manufacturing milligrams of it to manufacturing kilograms of it.
Yeah, so now that when you say manufacturing, these are, as I understand it, it's sort of like making beer, right?
That's one analogy. That's correct.
So they have vats, and they put in the right mix of chemicals, the right temperature, the right pressure, all that stuff. They stir it appropriately, and it grows in that whatever that environment is, right?
That's correct. And then they devise techniques for isolating it and purifying it.
And all that's done by automation, right?
Yes. For the most part, yes.
You do all this stuff, and now you get a kilogram of the stuff, whatever the drug is, and then I guess you have to turn it into pills or into something that goes in a shot, right?
In ours, for our particular drug, it's going to be is being encapsulated or put into a capsule.
Yeah, is that like fluid in a capsule, or is it powder, or is it granules?
It's a soft gel capsule with fluid inside.
Okay, so when I bite into those gel caps, I could be absolutely ruining the effect of the drug because it's supposed to get dissolved in my stomach or something, right?
Yeah, you want to swallow these capsules. These are not chewable capsules.
Okay, so yet another mistake I make in taking drugs, so I'll have to fix that one. Okay, so now when you measure the action of the drug, how do you do that? You suppose you get it in human trials, you just wait and see which ones die, or how do you do this?
In our case, we're able to monitor the progression of this disease in the heart valve over time. Echocardiogram.
Okay, so more computers. An echocardiogram, I guess you're sending in sound, right?
Go ahead. I'm not that familiar with exactly how the echocardiogram works, so to be honest with you.
Yeah, but that's right. So they do some sort of imaging.
Exactly.
And they look at the images over time, and you can see the calcium building up or not. Is that right?
Yes, they can calculate it. That's correct. And the way they calculate it is they look at the opening that occurs in these valves and that occur. And over time, as the calcium accumulates, this opening becomes smaller and smaller.
Okay, but the calcium doesn't accumulate instantaneously. It takes a long time. Right. So over what period of time do you have to deliver this drug to even measure its effectiveness?
Well, with the earliest that we did it in the clinical trials of Mayo, that Mayo did was 6 months. And they also looked at the same patients at 12 months.
So you can actually see the progress over 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, that's correct.
Is this like a disease or some other thing? Is it a biological thing that's causing this, or is it just that you have too much calcium and it just builds up?
No, it's a biological process.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
Well, it's car week here on the Monterey Peninsula, and so we have to start talking about cyber and cars. What else would you do on car week? Of course, I'm going to start out with my own story. It's not so much about cyber, but it certainly is about cars and duct tape. Yes, duct tape. the best. You know, if you're going to go to the moon or Mars, but one thing you want to make sure you have is duct tape. It can seal the capsule. It can probably do almost anything else you desperately need to do in a moment of mercy. So, long, long time ago, I was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was dating a woman who lived about 40 miles west of Pittsburgh. So I went to pick her up in my car, which was a Fiat Spider, little teeny yellow car. With a drop top and everything else. Picked her up, drove all the way to Monroeville, which is about 30 miles the other direction, 30 miles east of Pittsburgh, where we went to a movie. So we went to the movie. It was a Wonderful movie. I have no recollection of what the movie was. But when we got out of the movie, turns out I had a flat tire. Now, we looked at the flat tire, and it turns out there was a hole in the tire. Yes, it was previously bald, but now it had gone all the way through, and there was a hole about the size of a dime in the tire. No way you can pump it up. Hand pump, doesn't matter what kind of pump, it's just going to blow air out faster than it's going to take air in and hold it. But in the trunk, I had duct tape. So naturally, oh, and by the way, of course, the spare tire was flat. So much for the spare tire, if there was one at all. So duct tape it was. So I put duct tape over the tire. And of course, because it was bald, it had a nice smooth surface. Put about three layers of duct tape and started driving back from Monroeville into Pittsburgh. So about 30 miles later, and I was only going at the speed limit, which was probably 55 miles an hour at the time. And it held. It held until I got to a place where I could then go borrow another car and take her home. So that's my duct tape story, which has nothing to do with the cybernetic nature of things, but it is a car story and it is Car Week. So now, on to some other cyber-related stories associated with automotive.
Beginning in the 1770s, many people tried to make cars that would run on steam. Some early steam cars worked well, and some did not.
Starting with the first steam cars, of course, there was a feedback system. The steam could explode the container, whatever it was boiling in. It could generate too much power or not enough power. So there was always some method by which the driver could release some of the steam so it wouldn't put as much pressure on it. There were also automatic steam release valves. Another similar
method. There's a voice in my head that drives my ear. It's my baby calling, says I need you here. And it's 4:30 and I'm shifting gear. When she is lonely.
The Ford Model T, made between 1908 and 1927, cost less than other cars, but it was sturdy and practical. It ran well on dirt roads and fields because it could twist as it rolled over bumps. The Model T looked like an expensive car, but actually was very simply equipped.
Radio sings a forgotten song.
From 1915 to 1925, it only came in black because black paint dried faster than other colors, making it possible to build and sell more Model T's. For all of these reasons, more Model T's were sold than any other type of car. A total of just over 10,000.
Has, you know, sensors, actuators, communications, and control. The line rolled on. The cars were built as it moved along the line. The people stood still instead of having to move around. The efficiency of the cybernetic system made the cybernetic system that was the car at that time much more effective. And, of course, the car itself was a cybernetic system. It now had a steering wheel and a gas pedal and a brake and so forth.
No more speed, I'm almost there. Gotta keep cool now, gotta take care.
last car to pass, here I go. And the line of cars drove down real slow, whoa. And the radio played that forgotten song. Coming on strong. And the newsman sang his same song. Oh, one more radar lover gone. When I get lonely and I'm sure I've had enough, she sends the comfort coming in from above. We don't need no letter at all. We got the thing that's called radar love. We got the light in the sky.
In fact, you know, other than large-scale manufacturing, extraction of natural resources and so forth, the car was sort of the most cybernetic system, the most complex machine that people had ever encountered.
My pappy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln.
The Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance began in tandem with the Pebble Beach Road Races in 1950.
Have you heard the story of the hot rod race with the Fords and Lincolns was setting the pace? That story is true, I'm here to say I was driving that Model A. It's got a Lincoln motor and it's really souped up. That Model A body makes it look like a pup's got 8 cylinders and uses them all. Got overdrive, just won't stall. With a 4-barrel carb and a dual exhaust, with 4-11 gears you can really get lost. Got safety tubes, but I ain't scared. The brakes are good, tires fair. Pulled out of San Pedro late one night, the moon and the stars was shining bright. We was driving up Grapevine Hill, passing cars like they was standing still. Sudden, in a wink of an eye, a Cadillac sedan passed us by. Said, boys, it's a mark for me. By then, the taillight was all you could see. Now the fellas had ribbed me for being behind, so I thought I'd make the Lincoln unwind. Took my foot off the gas, and man alive, I shoved it on down into overdrive. Wound it up to 110. My speedometer said that I hit top end. My foot was glued like lead to the floor. That's all there is, and there ain't no more. Now the boys all thought, lost my sense, and telephone poles looked like a picket fence. They said, slow down, I see spots, the lines on the road just look like dots. Took a corner, sideswiped the truck, crossed my fingers just for luck. My fenders was clicking the guardrail post, the guy beside me was white as a ghost. Smoke was coming from out of the back when I started to gain on that Cadillac. Knew I could catch him, I thought I could pass. Don't you know by then we'd be low on gas. We had flames coming from out of the side. Feel the tension, man, what a ride. I said, look out, boys, I got a license to fly. And that caddy pulled over and let us by. Now all of a sudden she started knocking him down in the dip. She started to rock and I looked in the mirror. Red light was blinking, the cops was after my hot rod Lincoln. They arrested me and they put me in jail and they called my pappy to throw my bail. And he said, son, you're gonna drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln.
And that's the whole story of the Concours d'Elegance Car Week on the Monterey Peninsula. Come and see it yourself. Only a few days left before the big race in Pebble Beach. See you then, KMBY, 1240 AM.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. It's Car Week here on the Monterey Peninsula, so we're in cyber heaven. From the loud noises of the older cars without catalytic converters to the silent wolves of the new electric cars. The multi-million dollar cars sold at auction, nothing can really compare. So we're breaking the news on the Cyber Show to take you to the car show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions. Okay, we're back with Roger. And I'm going to start calling you a persuasion guru, because you've just about persuaded me to start taking all sorts of medical tests. The way the medical profession works these days is, you know, completely unlike when I was young. When I was young, the doctor was the person that knew it all, and they would tell you what to do, and you would do it. These days, doctors never tell you what to do, or almost never, right? What they say is, well, here's the range of all possibilities, and I will give you all the answers to any questions you have, and then you decide. And it's very much like our advisory services. We advise you decide. We don't take any responsibility for your decision, but we're going to tell you what we think. Yeah. What do you think of that approach to advice, as opposed to the approach where the advisor says, I know more than you, you should do this?
Yeah, well, it's worse than that. Let me pause on the medical thing, because this is an issue that it's a little emotional for me. So I've learned a lot about the U.S. standard of care. And what I've learned is, number one, I thought doctors were there to keep you healthy. That is not their job. It's not what they do.
So their job is not to make sick people well, which is from a Cary Grant film for many
years. No, they do. But you have to be sick. They're there to deal with your symptoms and to treat your illness, not to keep you from getting the illness. That's not their job. I mean, there are doctors now that do that, for sure. But, you know, they have to be that kind of doctor. The doctors I've had to deal with most recently, that's not their job. Their job, you know, was very specialized. They're surgeons to deal with, you know, the surgical solution, or they're oncologists to deal with the chemotherapy. So a lot of people in this country just don't understand. I didn't understand that. You know, if I'd known that, I would have consulted a whole different type of doctors, and probably maybe, who knows, maybe never would have gotten sick. I mean, I'm okay now, but who knows?
Preventive care is a fascinating thing. In some sense, it goes against insurance, in that insurance can charge more. They have good margins, so they can charge more if more things go wrong, right? And in many ways, it's like the antivirus arena, where a perfect antivirus product would prevent all viruses and you would never need it anymore, right? Whereas if we keep detecting things but we're not that good, then you need to keep paying us, right? So this recurring revenue model of business is sort of fundamentally different from the previous models, where you made something, you sold it, and then it was owned by the other person.
Yeah, it's also a broken system, I think. I mean, the insurance company, why would they not encourage? We do early detection of breast cancer, right? Early screening for breast cancer. I mean, why would you not do early screening for all cancers? I don't understand it. And if it's an economic decision, it's a pretty poor economic decision. It's a pretty heartless economic decision.
Oh, so, heartless is a different matter, right? So heartless, most of the world in business is heartless, right? Because the objective of any, you know, executive at a public company is to make money for the shareholders. It has nothing to do with heart. It's about money.
And I don't blame the insurance company for taking a purely profit motivated approach. But I do blame the FDA for making it have to work that way, because the FDA is not a for-profit organization. As far as I'm concerned, the way the FDA approaches cancer therapies is barbaric, right? I think FDA policy is responsible for thousands of cancer deaths every year, because it's so hard to get these therapies. They're so expensive. Until the FDA approves it, the insurance company doesn't cover it, right? So And I don't know what the holdup is. We saw during COVID that they can act quickly. We got a vaccine out pretty quickly. You know, they can if they have to, if they want to. They just don't want to. Why don't they want to? Because they just don't care. That's my conclusion.
I'm not convinced that the individuals don't care. I think there's a difference between people and organizations. And the governance of an organization is what produces the behavior of the organization. And the people of the organization are forced to live within that governance structure. And I think the change would be to change the governance structure to give the right, you know, feedback to the employees, to the workers, to say, here's what you get rewarded for and here's what you get punished for.
Yeah, absolutely. Change is definitely needed. I mean, I've heard forever about the healthcare crisis here in the United States. Why is this country so expensive? Why is this healthcare so expensive? And honestly, the healthcare system is not that good, given what it costs. For the fact that it's the most expensive, you would expect it to be the best. Well, it's not. You know, why is that? You know, it has nothing to do with, you know, the fact that there's insurance in the mix or that we don't have single payer.
Yeah, so let me interrupt you here. It has to do with the one of the things we don't talk about on the show, which is politics.
Politics. So
we're going to take a pause here.
All right.
Yeah, very good points. You know, and again, I want to be influenced. I want to be influenced and persuaded to do things or to look into things that I want to. Right. And I don't want to have to sort through everything on the planet to identify everything. You know, it's one of the things that helped me come to grips with marketing, having entered this industry as an engineer. And marketing is about influence. You know, now if I want to influence you to do things you don't want, I guess I'm bad or an idiot, whatnot. But if you actually do need a firewall, you want to get in the internet, you want to move this stuff forward, then you want to be influenced. You know, you don't want to have to do all the research and read all the technical jargon. You want someone in your humanly available time and knowledge to be able to say to you, you can trust us. We will do this. And then follow through on it. Right? You know, so, you know, Roger's doing a better job than I am, in stating this. But influence and persuasion are not bad things. They're bad things when used for bad purposes.
Which brings us to maybe the most fundamental challenge we have in this arena, in the cyber world. Computers are just no good at this. They underlying this problem is the notion of why something is, right? That is all of this stuff that's, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, you should do this, you should do that. There's always got to be a reason. And people base their decisions on emotional thoughts, but largely about why. And computers, you know, they don't have that. They have who, they have what, they have when, they have where, they have how, they don't have why. Without why, you can't make any decision about things. And of course, people are easily fooled in terms of why, because they get these, you know, wonderful emotional, you know, presentations to them that say, you know, children are dying in wherever of starvation. And if you give $12 a month, blah, blah, blah. And it's true. But when you put that in the pool of other things, you know, does that look more true than this? And now you get down to the credibility of the message, but the message could be anything. So it's not the message, it's the source. Now we're at the credibility of the source. And now you see modern technology, and we don't want to get into politics specifically, but the so-called deep fakes, the fakes where they put somebody else's voice into your face, is already being used to influence people. So you can't even tell whether the source is true. So this lack of source authentication, assuring that information is authentic and reliable, is fundamental to the challenge we face as a society in the cyber world as it's emerging.
Right. And as always, yes, as always, I'll stick with that one. These things were inevitable, right? You know, 1990, General Electric, we're putting that video conference center in, and we had this one VHS tape of that year's winners in computer graphics. And it was, you know, this one I always remember was, you know, a bunch of dinosaurs running around. But in 1990, the world's best, you know, the tools gave you silver Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? You know, but it moved, right? You could see that it moved. And we're talking to one of my colleagues and saying, all right, you know, we go out far enough, get out 30 years from this, and you're not going to be able to tell one picture, a real picture from a fake. It's literally physically impossible. You won't be able to tell the difference. And I remember having conversations back then. It's like, well, we can't have that. It's like, we're going to, and we'll survive it. But we had to imagine going through
that. Will we survive it?
it is a non-zero chance of surviving, right? You know, there are ways. This is not inevitably, you know, the end of the world, I don't think, but it's inevitably going to happen. So again, 20, 33 years ago, having these conversations, like, we show up in court and you've got a picture right there and it shows everything, but it's absolutely not real. And it looks exactly as real as anything else. How do we figure that out? Because it's going to happen. And now here we are.
All right. So I will tell you how it works in court. Any sort of digital evidence, any picture, any of that stuff, that's called hearsay. It's, you know, it's not an in-person person saying, I saw this happen. So as hearsay, it's only admissible under certain circumstances. And generally speaking, it has to be admitted. One of the exceptions to hearsay is a normal business record. And the way you get that normal business record in is you prove it's a normal business record by having the custodian for the business testify and say, well, you know, I'm the person that's in charge of these records of the business. We collect these records on a regular basis as part of our normal operation of the business. It's just a regular business record that we keep. And so, you know, I'm providing it here. I assured that what was in the records is the same thing. I printed it out using our printer, and here it is. Now, that doesn't mean that it's impossible that it went wrong. So we have an oppositional legal process in the United States where the other side can bring in a forensics expert like me, and I will look at it and I'll say, well, it's interesting that you say that because the font that it uses is a font that's no longer in widespread use. It's a font that was used in you know, the 1980s, and it looks like this was done on an Apple, and you testified that your computers are running Windows. Aha! Okay. Nice. So, but it's an oppositional system. So they then have their expert come back and say, yes, I understand that, but you failed to understand that, you know, they could have installed this package that would bring that font in. And I said, aha! But if I looked at the printout, on the back of the printout, there were these little blue dots produced by the laser printer that showed that the printer was serial number such and such, and that serial number was never sold to your company, and then back and forth, right? So that's what that dispute thing is all about. So there are reasonable ways to attribute actions to actors and to attribute documentary evidence to its source. And the process is, how did it come to be? How did it come to me? And what did I do with it? And that for every step in the chain of custody. And you have to establish a chain of custody, starting with reliable and authentic records. And what you produce has to be demonstrated to be reliable and authentic, an exception to the hearsay. So there are ways to do this, but that's not going to work in the internet where you just saw an advertisement the day before you were going to vote in the election. And the advertisement showed the person you were going to vote for, you know, having whatever bad thing they were supposed to do shown in front of you with their own voice. And even though it's a fake, there's a saying, right? A lie can get around the world.
World before a truth can put its boots on.
That's the point. Right? Lies spread just as quickly as truths, but there's a delay. Fascinating lie spreads virally very rapidly, and the truth chasing it never catches up.
Right. And I think I know the shape of the answer. I don't know all the details, but, you know, if I live long enough to see it, we can see if I'm right, you know. But I think it comes down to, as we're saying here, you know, in the court system, and, you know, we can work perfectly fine without ever being able to say technically, absolutely, that's a real photo. But somebody's taking responsibility for it. They're willing to say it's a real photo. That's good enough for now. I think in this world,
they're willing to testify under penalty of perjury.
Right. And I think we each do this all the time. You know, when we see a meme and share it, you know, so that aligns with our ideology or whatever we're doing it, we understand this. And right now, no one has any real reason to believe any, you know, and this, we're literally in a social media conversation right here. You know, in the social media apps we have right now, you see a screenshot, you have no reason to believe or not believe that it's real. And I think the answer is giving a reasonable ability to people to reasonably, you know, most often be correct in attributing something to some source. Raising the bar a little bit without going all the way, because we do this all the time as human beings.
So there are sort of two lines of approach to this, I think, for today. In the future, someday we might be really good at this, but in the meanwhile, so one line of thought is to provide
more and better ways for us to be able to tell that something is truthful and hopefully eventually have people actually be honest. Not that that's ever going to happen. But so in that positive realm, for example, there's iconography. So you see this lock on your browser that says, oh, this is SSL, right? So, and the lock is supposed to say it's secure, it's safe, whatever that means. It's baloney, but it's, you know, it's better than nothing. It means it was encrypted between where you got it on your browser and somewhere else. We don't know really where, of course, but there's all sorts of issues there. But that icon says that. And you can associate icons with other things to provide a visual or an audio or some other sense of what makes it good. There are also software products. One of them, I think, was called Blue Border, and it puts different colored borders around every window on your screen, indicating something about, you know, whether they're classified or not classified in the classified realm, or whether it's from your local computer or somewhere else, whatever it differentiates. So that's that approach. The other side of it is, and this is for today, I think we need to reduce the trust in information because that information is not trustworthy. And so that's, you know, the equivalent of giving you a shot that gives you the disease and your body learns how to react to it. We're going to do that in a cognitive sense. So we're going to cognitively give you a shot by producing a lot of falsehoods that start out looking realistic and at the end turn into something that's obviously a fake, and then saying, look, fakes look realistic in today's world and you can't tell the difference. Don't believe what you hear unless it's from a reliable source. And then it gives a list of reliable sources. Now, of course, they have to be reliable sources, but that's another issue. So I see the combination of both of those, iconography or some other indicator that provides that reliability for the generic stuff, not for somebody you personally know, but we all know somebody that we disagree with strongly over facts. But the other side is creating that belief that it's not true anymore, reducing the belief in the integrity of stuff we get off the internet, which, by the way, I have no idea of how anybody ever came to the belief that what you get off the internet has any kind of integrity, but that's a different issue.
Well, yeah, you know, I let's look at the most known classic iconography for this, a notary stamp. Now, which just means that some individual that you can personally meet, you know, has made some commitments, you know, to due diligence, to, you know, ensure that, you know, when they put that stamp on a piece of paper, there's some reason they did, right? And it's reliably, you know, reliably accurate to a workable level. And that little icon we see now, could you fake that? Yeah, I mean, you could sit there with a little with a paper clip and push it. You know,
it's too much effort. That works. That's not how that system works. Just for clarity. Those stamps are very specific, and that methodology is very specific. The stamp itself means nothing. And the registration, you know, what that means, in fact, is that the person who put on the stamp and took the two signatures or however many signatures of the parties and put it in their book and signed it themselves in the book, that they observed the thing that you saw, and they looked at the documentation required, and that's what was shown to them. They are not attesting to the fact that that's a true driver's license or a true anything. All they're saying is this stuff was presented to me. I saw it. I put my stamp on it. And there's a number associated with that stamp, and there's a description of what it was. And in court, what happens is that person comes in with their book in hand, the physical book in hand, opens up the book, looks at the number on the piece of paper with the stamp, says, that looks like my stamp. Doesn't say it is my stamp. That looks like my stamp. Here's my stamp. It looks the same. That number is written in my book as from this person. Yeah, that's from this person to that person. Yeah, signed with this size document, the descriptions match. That's all they say about it. It doesn't mean it's real. It doesn't mean it can't be faked. But you're right. It gets you way over the threshold of the trivial forgery, where I just make one and hand it over, because by the time you get to court, you know, that's authenticated with that human process.
And this is why I like the watermark, you know, the iconography of attestation. What it's saying is that, you know, somebody somewhere has attested to this, you know, image, you know, this, you know, shareable, you know, meme or whatever. There's some attribution to it. Now, are you actually going to, you know, click all through that before you share and everything else? No, but you might be microscopically more likely to be a little more comfortable with that than one without the iconography. because yeah, well, you know that no one is attesting that there's any attribution to it whatsoever, or somebody is. Now, is it real? Different question.
Right. So then you get to the questioned document examiner, who looks at that document and says, the ink on here was or was not the same ink, the same year of ink. The pen made the same kind of mark. There's an actual dent in this thing where that signature happened. And I looked at similar signatures, and there's similar dents in similar places for that same person and so forth, right? So you can drill down as far as you need to drill down if it's important enough, because it's physical. Right. And this is where we come to one of the problems in the digital world, right? The physical world is potentially infinitesimal. The digital world only gets down to the level of a bit. It's a one or a zero. You can drill no further than that. There's another thing that happens, and that is we see people using cryptographic checksums to authenticate things. And that's great, right? The problem in the archives and records management world is that that cryptographic checksum, as wonderful as it might be for the original sequence of bits, when you transform that document into a document for the new system 45 years later, so that people can still see what it says, because you don't have the hardware and software you had 40 years ago, you don't have it bit for bit identical, but that doesn't make the record any less valid as a record. So there's all sorts of problems. Another one is in the blockchain world. If somebody modifies a bit, all of a sudden the whole blockchain falls over, not just one link, the whole blockchain falls over because, there's a bit wrong. So, right. So that's one of the problems in the digital world that we have to resolve. And there are, by the way, our technical people that have created multi-signatures made up of multiple subcomponents so that you can have so many bit errors and still determine that it's authentic, except, of course, that it has at least this many bit errors. It's not perfect, but it's close. If they change the wrong bit, that's another problem in the digital world. If you change one bit, and that's what Jennifer Bayek told us about when we talked to her, right? You change one bit and the entire phone network goes down.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Okay, so you've probably heard this one before, but this is the joke about outrunning the bear. So there's two people in the woods. They're out in the middle of nowhere and they spot a bear. And one of them looks at the other and says, "Oh my God, there's a bear." And the other guy says, "Well, I guess we better run then." And the first guy says, "Well, you can't outrun a bear." And the second guy says, as he starts to run, "I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you." We're talking here with Jennifer Bayek. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you.
So I understand that you went from the successful, let's just say, selling off of all the assets of AT&T's huge financial stuff into Bear Stearns, where, so what happened exactly to Bear Stearns, and was it your fault?
I can honestly say it wasn't my fault. In fact, I started as a security architect. Right. And at that time, there was no such thing as a chief information security officer. And I reported into someone who had mostly mainframe security experience. And there were, for reasons entirely unrelated to us, a modern CIO structure created where each business unit had their own development CIO type. They called them CIOs. But then there was a corporate level CIO. And so that's
a fairly common structure, right?
So now it is, but it
was whole company has a model of everything, mm-hmm. and copies of it are down below. And the corporate does some set of services that are common and provides some guidance that's common. And then all the details are handled for the different companies appropriately, right?
Yeah. It was probably somebody like McKinsey that went around selling it, but yeah.
That's not a bad structure, right? That's a good structure, especially if for global businesses, you're going to need subsidiaries in every country, or you're going to have a nightmare, you know, pulling apart all the legal stuff, right?
Absolutely. So I was at that point, the chief security architect. So I went to the chief architect's office under the global place.
Okay. So when they did that shift of the whole business, you ended up in the top.
Well, I'm sure my peers wouldn't call it the top because they think development is the top of the world, right?
Well, but all right. So as an executive level, you know, you were in the holding company that set the standard for everybody everywhere, and everything rolled up to you.
I was the highest ranking person whose sole job was information security.
And what was your rank?
Managing director.
Managing director of the global Bear Stearns cybersecurity everything.
I didn't do operations. I was in architecture. So we kind of, right. You know, the people, there was still a SecOps, but they were lower level than me.
Right. So generally speaking, you know, you have specification, which is what you did, verification, which is what audit does, right. And execution.
Yes.
And the separation of duties is fundamental to doing that well, right?
Yes. In fact, I had a little mantra that my boss said, policy, monitoring, no implementation. I was not allowed to implement. I can design, right. I can tell people what the standards are, but I cannot implement them.
Yeah, and that's a separation of duties that's entirely appropriate for an organization of that type, which almost nobody does today, foolishly. And that's one of the many reasons that we have a lot of insider bad things that happen.
Yes, that's true. There are a lot of different ways that people do organize themselves now. I have this. What I hear when you're saying that is three lines of defense. Are you familiar with that being called that, three lines of defense?
I haven't heard that one lately, but so, you know, even if I know all about it, you should tell the audience.
Okay, three lines of defense. The people in the trenches that are looking up for the threats, you know, trying to keep them out of the periphery, that's the first line of defense. That's operations. That's where people implement things and build the structures that protect the firm. The second line of defense is like a little drone or a monitor looking over what's going on in the first line of defense and saying, hey, you missed a spot over here, or, you know, you need a better structure, you know, a framework. You know, they call it framework building in the second line of defense. And then in the third line of defense, which is audit, if the first line doesn't catch it and the second line can't catch it, or the first line won't listen to the second line to fix it, audit gets to be independent and report whatever they see. They get to do hands-on online testing of everything that
read only,
but hands-on online, because they like you said, you can look at what's happening.
Yeah, they can observe but not change.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's right. Okay.
So
I have not heard that characterization of it before. So I thank you for educating me and everybody else always.
My pleasure. It was made up by the Basel, banking regulators, but I'll take credit for popularizing it. I like the analogy. So I was sitting there, kind of a borderline on the first and second line, because I was doing architecture, even though I didn't implement it. Now, what do we have? 9/11 happens, and the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force gets tasked with bringing Wall Street together to make sure that this critical infrastructure of the financial system is completely secure from terrorism.
Hang on, completely secured is a ridiculous thing.
Right. I tried to tell them that. They were like, no, we need it completely secured, and we're going to get, somehow they knew somebody who worked at Bear Stearns in a very high level position, you know, three times over my head. And that person contacted the CIO, who was then my boss. I was then reporting to him directly. And then they said, you have to host these people, introduce them to the other security officers in Wall Street. Just have a conference, just listen to them. So I did that. So we had them in the executive boardroom with all of the CIOs, or, you know, not this, they weren't called CISOs yet. Only one of them was, Steve Katz. The others were just called head of security or information security officer or something like that. But we had probably about 10 or 15 firms, and we listened to what the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force wanted us to do. And they wanted us to do a tabletop exercise to see what would happen if terrorists tried to take down Wall Street. So I had to come up with a tabletop exercise and host everybody. Now, instead of just one big conference room or in the auditorium, and all the staff from all of those companies are there. And we present this bad scenario that's happening, and we send people off into their different rooms to figure out what their result would be. And so my boss gets on the podium to welcome everybody to one of these meetings and says, and now I'd like to turn it over to our chief information security officer, Jennifer Mayock.
Congratulations. You've turned into the CISO of Bear Stearns. Congratulations on the spot.
Yes.
What a promotion.
So you recall the head of Bear Stearns, the guy, you know, Art. Anyway, so the next time there is a kind of, you know, upper management social, I don't know what it was for. Maybe it was like promotion week or something. And my boss is there, who's the global CIO, and brings me over to meet Art. CIO introduces me to the CEO and says, I would like you to meet our chief information security officer. And the CIO doesn't look at me, looks right at the CIO and says, we have a what?
Yeah, which is the same thing that you were saying.
Well, within a couple of years, it was a regulatory requirement for the big banks to have a chief information security officer. So we were only a couple of years behind that requirement. And he could see it coming. That is why he did it. He wanted to be the first. And he was always a very smart guy. Pete Cherisea, thank you. Anyway.
Out of the frying pan into the fire.
Right. Yeah. And again, you know, like so many careers across that span of time in this space, I don't know. I'm sure there were some linear ones. You know, I know people who have been in the same job for decades and so forth, but it usually looks like that.
Yeah, no, I don't know any of them. So
yeah.
One of the interesting things that I'm aware of is that the lifespan of a chief information security officer, maybe it's not true anymore, but it used to be about 18 months. And I know quite a few CISOs who, you know, when they had that job, as soon as you get the job, you immediately start looking for the next one, because you know it takes about a year, year and a half to get another job, and you'll be out in 18 months anyway.
Well, I think that's part of the evolution of the market, right? You know, I used to make a joke, you know, whenever I meet someone who's a CISO, I would say 24 months, right? You know, 2 years. And if you're like 18 months, you know, or 27 months in the job, I'm like, oh, so you're looking, right? But I think that's actually stabilized a little bit, right? You know, I would have to go look, but my feeling is that CISOs, again, each of these things we go through, eventually we tend to arrive at the right spot. You know, often it's what was said originally, which is a CISO needs to have the authority and the responsibility and not just be, you know, a fusible link that the actual C-suite uses to keep, you know, themselves out of trouble. So after a decade or so of you know, bad CISOing, you know, that sort of proves itself out. And I think we've ratcheted up to the spot where most CISOs are actually probably at least properly empowered.
I don't think so. But, you know, I guess, you know, the number that you're looking at is a different number, different set than I am. There aren't that many of them out there, actually. But when it comes to being a CISO, you know, at this point, you know, Jennifer was not a chief information security officer. She was, you know, sort of an auditor or a, you know, cybersecurity person or an emergency response or a red teamer. So all these different roles that she took over time, when you talk about the experience you need to be in charge of something like this, it's very substantial. It's not like, you know, being a CFO where you can learn the rules and the game and then start to take on a CFO position in a small company, right? So as you get up the ladder, of course, it's much more complicated because a CFO has a lot of responsibility advising the CEO in a wide variety of things, you know, anything that has to do with money in the company. So is there anything in a company that doesn't have to do with money? You know, probably very few things, right? But the same is true of a CISO, right? Somebody in charge of HR, different world. Chief technology officer, you know, completely different world. It's finite. It's very expansive in what you have to know, but it's a finite subset of what's within the company.
Right.
Whereas the CISO has to cross all boundaries. And so the complexity of that is sort of, and that's one of the reasons that you see these job openings in this space. And the job openings say, you know, what do you need? Yeah, you know, 5 years of experience in each of these 47 things. So it's just like, okay, so I have to be about, you know, 250 years old before I'm qualified for this position, plus when I grew up and got educated.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Jennifer survives the crash, or the bear, or the crash of the bear. Roger advises 10,000 companies. That's a one with 50. More pitches gone wild, fraud, spies, and lies, and who knows what else. Why would who know what? We'll find out next week on The Cyber Show.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.